Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. Today we are talking about the short life of Madeleine of Valois, which stands out not for its longevity or sweeping influence, but for its poignant brevity. Born into the House of Valois in France, Madeleine's destiny would weave with that of Scotland, earning her the evocative title of the Summer Queen, a moniker that established both her ephemeral reign and the fleeting warmth of her presence. All right, so let's get into it. Madeleine was born on August 10th, 1520. I'm totally going to butcher it because I am not a French speaker. Château de Saint-Germain-en-Laye. Somebody will tell me in the comments, I'm sure. It's a castle in France. As the fifth child of Francis I of France and Claude, Duchess of Brittany, Madeleine was born into privilege and responsibility. So she would have been born right after the Field of Cloth of Gold happened, because that was in 1520 as well, in the summer. The legacy she inherited was rich. Her mother, Claude, was the eldest daughter of Louis XII of France and Anne, Duchess of Brittany. However, from the very outset, Madeleine's health cast a shadow over her royal lineage. Described as frail from birth, her early years were spent in the temperate climes of the Loire Valley, shielded from the biting cold of Paris that her father feared might exacerbate her health issues. As a child, Madeleine, along with her sister Margaret, was entrusted to the care of their aunt Marguerite de Navarre. Their bond was cemented in these formative years, particularly after their father's remarriage led them to the household of their new stepmother, Eleanor of Austria. But despite this protective cocoon, Madeleine's health remained a concern. By the time she celebrated her 16th birthday, she was grappling with tuberculosis, a daunting ailment for the time. The political landscape of 16th century Europe, of course, was a tapestry of alliances sealed with marital ties. 3 years prior to Madeleine's birth, the Franco-Scottish Treaty of Rouen had been inked, reinforcing the Auld Alliance, a historic bond between France and Scotland. This treaty was designed to counterbalance the increasing influence of England, and it included a pivotal provision: a marriage between a French princess and the Scottish king. In 1530, the wheels of this diplomatic marriage were set in motion when John Stuart, Duke of Albany, was tasked with finalizing a union between King James V of Scotland and Madeleine. However, Madeleine's fragile health brought another name into consideration as well, Mary of Bourbon. Little did anyone predict then how the Scottish king's heart and diplomatic imperatives would intersect, altering the course of Madeleine's life. Despite concerns about her health, and initially thinking that Mary of Bourbon would actually marry James, as they say, the heart wants what it wants. James V of Scotland traveled to France in 1536, originally to meet Mary of Bourbon, but after he met Madeleine, he was instantly smitten. Her fragility did not deter him. Instead, he ardently sought her hand in marriage. The thought of Madeline's relocation to Scotland's colder climate understandably alarmed her father, Francis I. He hesitated, apprehensive about the potential risk to her health. However, her evident interest in the Scottish king, combined with James V's persistence, finally swayed the French monarch. And the marriage contract was signed on November 26, 1536. Their union was celebrated at Notre Dame in Paris on January 1st, 1537. Following their vows, there was a huge banquet at the Louvre Palace, reaffirming the amalgamation of the two royal houses. Francis even gave Madeline a very generous dowry, a testament to the significance of this alliance. In May 1537, following a series of festivities all through France, Madeline and James set sail for Scotland. Their journey was eventful. They actually traded fish with an English fleet near Bamburgh. And as they reached Scottish shores, Madeline's health was actually evidently declining at that point. They landed in Leith on the 19th of May, 1537. Madeline brought with her to Scotland her entourage of French courtiers, an impressive assortment of possessions, a testament to her royal stature. She brought precious jewelry, opulent furniture, and her French legacy was evident in her new homeland. She even brought with her her ensemble of household staff, including her former governess and secretary, ensuring a semblance of home in this foreign land. Alas, the shadow that had hung over Madeline's life since birth soon cast its darkest pall. Merely a month after her arrival in Scotland, with a heart-wrenching letter to her father expressing optimism about her health, her journey was cut tragically short. On July 7, 1537, the Summer Queen breathed her last, cradled in the arms of her heartbroken husband at Holyrood Palace. Even in death, Madeline's impact was palpable. Her funeral at Holyrood Abbey witnessed a sea of mourners draped in black, a testament to the profound loss that Scotland felt. The grave where she lay beside James II would actually be desecrated centuries later, but legends persisted about her timeless beauty. Madeline's personal artifacts, from her childhood treasures to her regal attire, would be documented in later years, providing glimpses into her short-lived yet impactful life. When James V remarried, remnants of his life with Madeline remained. Among the treasures at Edinburgh Castle, artifacts gifted to Madeline during her childhood in France stood as silent witnesses to a love story that, though brief, was unforgettable. Today, we are talking about rethinking Catherine Howard, much maligned Catherine Howard, Henry's fifth wife. You guys, I'm talking about Catherine Howard today because I got to tell you, I try really hard to stay off of Twitter. Twitter was a crap show. I'm not even going to blame the new owner of Twitter. Twitter's been like a terrible place on the internet, like for years. Twitter is horrible. Twitter is just a terrible, nothing good happens on Twitter. I mean, every once in a while, I like looking at, like, you know, yesterday with the hurricane in Southern California, I liked like kind of looking up pictures and seeing what was going on. And, you know, every once in a while, there's something. I don't want to say nothing good comes of Twitter, but I think Twitter's a net negative for society. But I did happen to see things kind of exploding in the Tudor social media world last week because there is an author. I'm not going to say their name because I don't want to get involved in like anything weird. But there's an author who has a book coming out. This book is quite controversial, because the book claims to have found the sword that beheaded Anne Boleyn. And people are up in arms because they haven't done any kind of testing on the sword. They haven't been able to establish its provenance. When asked about why they haven't established provenance, the answer is simply, well, the family that told me is super wealthy, so they have no reason to lie. And the author of the book then, when you go through their Twitter page, because I caught the bait. I got hooked. You didn't get hooked? I got hooked when I saw a friend of mine, Adrienne Dillard, who's speaking at TudorCon, actually. She posted a negative review on Goodreads about the book. And so I read that and I just, you know, you go down the rabbit hole. Got hooked.
hate that. I hate that feeling. And then you're like, it's been half an hour and you're just like, you've been in this daze and you're like, what happened to the last half an hour? Like, that's like a half an hour of my life I'm never going to get back. So I was looking at somebody's Twitter feed, which like means nothing to me. Honestly, stay off Twitter.
Okay.
Public service announcement, just stay off Twitter. So this particular person makes a lot of misogynistic comments about women. And, you know, like stuff that's like, why you even gotta go there? Why do you even gotta go there? Like, what are you thinking? And I guess they enjoy the attention that happens with, you know, there's people like that that are just trolls and like they just like the attention. And maybe that's what this person is. Maybe. It had me looking at their feed for 20 minutes, you know, so it won. The trolls won. But what I will say is the thing that had me want to make a video is they posted this tweet about Catherine Howard and had how she had the IQ of a Little Mix groupie. Little Mix, if you don't know, is a girl band that started on Britain's version of the X Factor. And, you know, this tweet had all of these likes and all these people saying, yeah, you know, and I mean, there were some people saying, yeah, I'm not happy with the way you talked about her there and not loving the end of this tweet and all of that. But I was really surprised, especially because I don't spend a lot of time on social media, because I don't interact with a lot especially Tudor social media. I don't realize how many people still assume things about Catherine Howard. And like, I kind of have thought, like, Gareth Russell wrote his book years ago, Young, Damned, and Fair. I mean, it's been several years. And you know, I kind of just assume that people have realized that you can't just have this black and white view of people, like anybody. People are good. People are bad. You can be one person and be both really dumb and really smart at the same time. I do some really stupid things, you guys, and I'm also pretty smart. And yet I do really dumb things every once in a while. You know, like I look at that and I say, boy, Heather, that was dumb. So people are nuanced. You know, there's a crazy idea that you don't get on Twitter. There's nuance in the world. And so I kind of forget, because I'm in my own little world, I kind of forget that people just don't have very nuanced opinions about Catherine Howard. She seems to be the one that it's still like okay to say horrible things about. And I'm not cool with that. I'm not cool with that on her behalf. I'm certainly not a Catherine Howard expert. I would never claim to be. Gareth Russell is. You should read his book. Claire Ridgway is. Like, we did that video for TudorCon, or before it was called TudorCon, the Tudor Summit back in 2017, 2018, where she talked about the fall of Catherine Howard. But, you know, Catherine Howard, she's nuanced. So we're going to talk about her today, whether she really had the IQ of a Little Mix groupie and why you should stay off Twitter, in a short 10-minute video presenting a more nuanced, fuller version of Catherine Howard's life. So, of course, she was the fifth wife of Henry VIII, and she's often, like I said, relegated in the footnotes of history to being the foolish girl or the one who really did commit adultery, the adulterous queen. Portrayals of her life tend to dwell on the scandalous. She was queen for a very short time, and so people tend to, like, focus on the scandalous part. And so, you know, you see stories of Henry VIII's six wives, and they'll spend 5 minutes on Catherine Howard, and it'll just be on Henry Mannix and Francis Darham and Thomas Culpepper and beheading, and that's it. And it's just like, this girl in many ways was a victim. This girl was, you know, is actually kind of smart sometimes. Again, made some really stupid decisions. Not going to try to excuse that. I do it. And that doesn't take away from who she was and, you know, what she accomplished. It needs to be taken in the whole, right? So we're going to challenge some misconceptions and talk about her intelligence, her adaptability, and her resilience that she displayed amidst the treacherous waters of the Tudor court. So, of course, she was born into the powerful Howard family, but her early life was marked more by her family's ambitions than her own choices, of course. This is for any woman, for any person, for any child. While she was of noble birth, her early years were far from luxurious. She was sent to live in the household of her step-grandmother, the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk. This was a very lax environment filled with young women and young men. Boundaries didn't really, they were squishy. And her youth made her particularly vulnerable in this home. Frances Derham's entrance into her life was a manifestation of this vulnerability. She was exposed to his advances, a relationship that was at best inappropriate given their respective positions and ages. He was older, more worldly. He exploited the environment, casting a shadow over Catherine's formative years. But he wasn't the only man from her past that would come back to haunt her. The young men and women of the Dowager Duchess's household were often left to their own devices, leading to relationships and liaisons that would be considered scandalous by the standards of the Tudor court. These experiences, rather than being indicative of her supposed recklessness, actually underscore a lack of guidance, a lack of protection for her during her very formative years. Can't blame her for this stuff that was happening when she was a child, right? Noble women, even children, were treated as commodities. Their worth was tied to their purity and their ability to forge alliances through marriage. And her upbringing, lacking in any kind of proper oversight, left her ill-prepared for the life that she would lead as queen. However, her experiences also gave her a unique understanding of human behavior, a trait that would serve her well, though not long enough, in the dangerous environment of Henry VIII's court. So Henry VIII's marriage to Catherine Howard in 1540, just weeks after his annulment of the marriage from Anne of Cleves, took many by surprise. She was young, vivacious, strikingly beautiful, a stark contrast to the aging and irritable king. While the initial stages of the marriage seemed to be marked by genuine affection, he seemed to really love her. She brought him back to life. She was just his absolute jewel, all of this. But the power dynamics can't be ignored. She was queen, this placed her at the center of courtly politics. And the Howard family, which was always eager to regain their influence, viewed the marriage as an opportunity. They hoped to leverage their connection to the throne and rival the powerful Seymour family. The Seymours, of course, were related, obviously, to Edward Seymour, the king's son, the future king, the heir. And the Howards wanted to try and see if they could get back in there and get some influence of their own. Catherine was still in her teens, and she found herself navigating this web of alliances, rivalries, and conspiracies. It wasn't long before Catherine's past came to haunt her. The political adversaries of the Howard family saw an opportunity to bring them down by exposing Catherine's previous relationships. When her alleged indiscretions with Thomas Culpepper during the marriage came to light, the situation escalated rapidly. Yet even in the midst of the crisis, Catherine showcased her adaptability. She skillfully defended herself during her interrogations. She often outmaneuvered the questioners. But given Henry's unpredictable nature and the evidence mounted against her, her fate seemed sealed. Despite her youth and the tragic end to her time as queen, Catherine was not this naive and foolish girl that history often portrays her as. Beneath the surface, she demonstrated a sharp understanding of the court politics and of human behavior. Upon becoming queen, she recognized the importance of patronage, and she began to bestow favors upon her Howard relatives, ensuring that they regained their places at court. Her ability to charm and influence Henry, who was a king known for his mercurial temperament, is indicative of her like emotional and social intelligence. She revitalized Henry. She made him feel young and vibrant again. And for a time, they actually appeared genuinely happy. Also, her interactions with ambassadors and foreign dignitaries reflected a woman who was well aware of her image and the diplomatic implications of her role. Her conduct during diplomatic receptions and the letters that she penned showcased her wit and her understanding, her growing understanding of international politics. There's also that time, the Christmas of 1540, when Anne of Cleves came back. She was so gracious and so generous. She gave Anne a puppy, right? And then the two women danced together. And it was kind of like this, she could have been really vindictive, or she could have been like acting jealous, or it could have been weird, but it wasn't. And that's kind of a sign of her emotional intelligence, I would think. She was in many ways a product of her time, trapped in a patriarchal system that overlooked and undervalued the capabilities of women. Her intelligence and her adaptability was overshadowed by the scandal that marked the end of her life, though. And if we can look at that, we get a more nuanced view of this misunderstood queen. Her downfall began when the allegations of her prior relationships emerged, especially her relationship with Francis Darham and her music teacher, Henry Mannix. While these liaisons occurred before her marriage to the king, in the highly charged political atmosphere of the Tudor court, they became weapons against her. And then as her detractors began to dig deeper, they uncovered her affair with Thomas Culpeper, who was very, very close to Henry, was a gentleman of the king's privy chamber. Their secret meetings, which were facilitated by Jane Boleyn, became the central point of the accusations. The tragedy is that Catherine, a young woman who had been manipulated and used by older men all of her life, found herself once again victimized by the men at court. The end was swift and brutal. Darham and Culpeper were executed. Catherine, after being stripped of her title as queen, was executed February 3rd, 1542. She was just about 19 years old at the time. Henry Mannix escaped execution because it was clear that his relationship with her had ended before she became queen. So he was lucky. The narrative that took shape after Catherine's execution was one of a promiscuous and frivolous young queen who recklessly endangered the monarchy. Historians, chroniclers, even balladeers of the time painted her as this lightheaded queen, focusing obsessively on her relationships and her alleged indiscretions. Her youth was weaponized against her to describe her as naive, her charm as deceitful, and her relationships as promiscuity. Maybe somebody could have said, hey, let's not take a 17-year-old and make her queen. That would be an idea. Instead of like blaming her, right? All right. Much of this portrayal was fueled by a combination of misogyny and also the political motivations of those who benefited from her downfall. In the subsequent centuries, as her story was retold, the nuances of her life, her vulnerabilities, her intelligence, the power plays that she was embroiled in were overshadowed by the scandal. The historical bias cemented her image as the failed fifth wife of Henry VIII, with little regard for the complexities and nuances of her life. I think it's crucial that we reassess her legacy, and I'm glad that historians are doing that. Like I said, notably Gareth Thrussell with his book Young, Damned, and Fair. Highly recommend you read it if you want to dig deeper into Catherine Howard. There are others out there as well. Check out the video with Claire Ridgway. She was a young woman. She was young. Like, who hasn't done dumb things with a teenager? I'm in my late 40s. I still do dumb things. And she was thrust into the highest echelons of power with very little agency over her life, navigating, doing her best to navigate this treacherous court filled with older, experienced players. And you know what? She actually did it for a while. I think she probably did better than I would have done. Despite the challenges, she showed resilience, adaptability, and intelligence. Her life serves as a stark reminder of the vulnerabilities of women in a patriarchal society, especially those in positions of power. Her story is not just one of tragedy, but also of strength. She managed to captivate a king, influence court politics, and engage in international diplomacy, all while facing immense personal and political challenges and pressures. In remembering Catherine, we should look beyond the scandalous narratives and recognize a multifaceted individual, a young queen who faced her challenges with grace and courage. By doing so, we give voice to a woman who for too long has been silenced by history's biases. So that's my Catherine Howard spiel. I just really feel bad for her. I just think she deserves better than frivolous tweets saying that she has the IQ of a little mixed groupie. And I mean, as if there's anything wrong with being a little mixed groupie. I looked up some of their songs on YouTube. They've some decent songs. Like, what does that even mean? So thanks for listening to me, Ben. I'm going to start like a thing like Heather Bents about this stuff. I got to watch it, though, because, man, I wrote a negative book review about a book a couple of years ago. The people that came after me. It's a good thing I try not to pay attention to that stuff very much. I'm just doing my thing, speaking my truth. That's all I can do. So thanks for listening to my spiel on Catherine Howard and my PSA on staying off of Twitter.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe. History and Coffee, Heather Tesco. You will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, send for baby sweating. Blow, northern wind.